We wrapped up another busy week on Connecticut Today, Friday, May 22nd, heading into the Memorial Day weekend. We spoke to an area college professor as we approach 1 year since the disappearance of Jennifer Farber Dulos. He talked about media coverage of that case and how it may have altered perceptions of violent crime. We also talked with an author of a book that illustrates how past presidents get together and get along, and whether or not that has changed in the era of Donald Trump. We just about past the 1 year, and again, I hesitate to use the word anniversary here, so I won't. The 1 year mark, shall we say, is about a year ago that we all became, wise and aware of the case of Jennifer Farber Dulos, who, you know, still unfortunately to this day has not been found. She went missing. Mother of multiple children, the chief suspect in that case, Fotis Dulos, being arrested and then later committing suicide. So who knows if we will ever find out what the ultimate judgment is in the Dulos case. But we've had about a year to kind of chew that case over and talk about it from different aspects. Of course, you always look at it. The public always looks at it from the top layer of the crust, you know, a violent crime aspect. But there are other aspects of that. I want to talk about that. Our next guest teaches classes on crimes and the media. He's a professor and chair of sociology, criminal justice, and anthropology at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. We welcome Professor Alan Bruce to Connecticut Today. Professor, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Professor Bruce. I appreciate it. Boy, it's hard to imagine because the way time does fly by in an all-encompassing case like this, Professor, that it's been about a year since the disappearance in the Dulos case. And boy, this case really, Professor, has taken just about every twist and turn that sometimes modern, I guess the phrase would be headline-grabbing violent crime often takes.
Yes, that's right. And I think the important point that you make here is that this is an example of headline-grabbing crime. And I think that's an important point here because the level of publicity, you know, is fantastic.
And, you know, you look at a case like this, Professor, and you and I, you can see a case like this, right? And when you see it develop with the requisite elements that we would have in this case, you can almost figure that within one or two or three days of the modern news cycle, this thing is going to be at least all over the country, and as it ended up, you know, being talked about all over the world.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, this is one of the, issues that we get into in my class, is that we're really interested in, you know, how people form their perceptions about crime. And as you say, we get a crime like this, that moves from being, you know, a local tragedy to a crime that is of, you know, international news. And so one of the things that we are very concerned with in the class is to think a little bit about how that impacts the way that people think about crime in general.
Professor, through your roots in sociology and anthropology, I would think that you may have an opinion as to whether or not human fascination with crime, like the Dulos case or other heinous cases across the country, as we can assume that she did meet some sort of ultimate tragedy, a lot of that is would you say that it's inbred in the human condition? I mean, for some reason, is there an anthropological or a sociological reason that we're drawn to coverage of crimes like this?
I don't know if I would phrase it quite the way that you do, but I think that there is the fact that these types of cases, on the face of them, they seem pretty, I hesitate to use the word simple, but in other words, there is, you know, there's a person that's identified as an offender, there's a person who is a victim, and I think that is, in terms of getting information out to the public, I think that is relatively, sort of an easy story to tell. as opposed to something that may appear to be less cut and dried. And so I think that people are used to, they're used to getting that type of story. And I think because of that, they become comfortable with it and they come to expect that.
And Professor, also, if this had been a case of a disgruntled couple, as it was, going through some sort of a split up here, a messy divorce, if this had not ended in, you know, an apparent tragedy here, but, you know, sides parted after, you know, a year-long battle over millions of dollars in stock, I mean, you know, there's no aspect of violence there too. And I've always thought, Professor, and kind of musing on my show, that for some reason we have an attraction or a fascination with, unfortunately, some of the violence in cases like this, and that may feed into what you're thinking about as well.
Yes, there's definitely a fascination with violence. And one of the things, again, in my classes that I very much focus in is I focus on what people think about the amount of violent crime. And one of the things that I found consistently, and this is one of the reasons that I began teaching the class, is that when I ask students about how much violent crime there is, it is always, students always make errors in the direction that there is way more violent crime they think happens than is actually happening in reality. And so I think that is not to downplay the seriousness of violent crime in any way whatsoever, but it's to make the point that people do have an expectation that violent crime is way higher than certainly our arrest data indicates.
And, you know, Professor, and by the way, the guest is Professor Alan Bruce of Quinnipiac University. There's always been a kind of a running debate in the media business, radio, television, newspapers, and you probably know what this is. And there's a rather callous, I don't want to say joke, but a label given to it that really stuck to a lot of TV newscasts over the past 10 or 20 years, leading into what you say. And in the business here, we have a scenario, well, you know, over that shop or that station, you know, quote unquote, if it bleeds, it leads. And playing into what you just said, Professor, there's a big debate in this industry, you know, in a major metropolitan city, if there's one or two shootings overnight in a city of 8 or 9 million people, as tragic as that may be, does leading with that on your newscast kind of cast a false narrative or a false reality out there?
I don't think it casts a false reality in the sense that, yes, that does happen. But I think that you're right. The falseness of the narrative is that this is what is most typical, or this is what we might come to expect, when reality is that this is just one slice of all the crime that takes place.
So when you, Professor, posed that question, you said a couple of seconds ago, to some of your students in the class, and they gave you whatever answers they did, were you said they were surprised when they were confronted with the reality. Why did they say, if you followed up and asked them about this, why did they think that they were so off on this? I would imagine it engendered a fascinating discussion between you and your students.
Yeah, it did, and it's really interesting because the estimates, just to give you some examples.
Sure. Yeah.
We may be talking nationally about, and again, when we talk about these numbers, they're all a tragedy, and so I don't wish to trivialize that. But when we're talking about nationally in terms of homicides, we're maybe talking currently something in the region of 15,000 ish people. And students would estimate, some of them would estimate over a million homicides in a year, which, is incredible. And when we ask them about it, it is almost 100% that, well, that's what I'm hearing about in the media, that's what I'm getting on Facebook, that's what I'm getting in social media, that's what I'm hearing from my friends. All you ever hear is violence, violence, violence. So they were very, very clear that is, a major major factor to them, is that through the various media sources that they consume, they're hearing about violence.
it's kind of, Professor, is it not a chicken or the egg kind of thing? Like, what engenders their perception? Is it the media, or is it not only students but people in general? Is it the lack of curiosity, or the lack of going to other media sources that you might not have marked as your favorites but should do to get a wider coverage? I would imagine that's a fascinating discussion as well.
Yeah, it is, and that's a really good question, Paul. The fact is that a lot of people, and, you know, again, when I teach a class, students will say this, that they are generally not inquisitive, in the sense that if they get information, about sensational crime, and they hear that over and over again, they do tend to accept that as, you know, a portrayal of objective reality. And so they admit themselves that until they often take the class, not necessarily my class, but other criminal justice classes, they have never really stopped to consider that the things they hear about and the things they're concerned about may actually only represent a very small proportion of the overall crime picture.
Professor, hang on. I want to talk with you about some thoughts you had regarding bail and the bail process. Fascinating discussion. Professor Alan Bruce is with us. Professor Bruce teaches sociology, criminal justice, and anthropology at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. Professor, hang on. We'll be back to you as we pass the one-year mark of the Dulos case, which, of course, we talked about extensively here on Connecticut Today and on WICC. We will continue with Dr. Alan Bruce coming up right after this on Connecticut Today. And as we pass the one-year mark of the Dulos case, of course, Fotis Dulos committing suicide, still no sign of what ultimately happened to Jennifer Farber Dulos. We take a look back at that and aspects of how crime is covered and how that leads into perceptions of people. Professor Alan Bruce, a professor and chair of sociology, criminal justice, and anthropology at Quinnipiac University, joins us for a few more minutes. Professor Bruce, I read what you had to say about bail being an additional issue here, and boy, people talk about that all the time. And you know, we have the situation not too far away from us, Professor, in New York City, where, you know, cash bail has been eliminated for all but the most violent offenders. Talk a little about the perception of bail and whether it may or may not be doing the job here.
Yeah, that's, again, another really good question. And this is something that I challenge my students to think about in various classes. And, you know, one of the issues to really consider is, what is the purpose of bail, right? So because, the purpose of bail being that we want to make sure that people turn up to their court hearings. We have to remember that prior to trial, the people who are held, they are not guilty. And so I think the question very frequently with bail that we have to ask is, well, what is the purpose of bail? Is it just to make sure that people are going to turn up for their cases? And if it is, we need to think about what's realistic there. So in other words, if you're concerned about somebody leaving the country, for example, taking that person's passport away may be sufficient.
Yeah.
If you're concerned about a person not turning up for court and have good reason to believe that, maybe that person shouldn't be granted bail. Perhaps if you believe that a person is a danger to themselves or to others, again, perhaps that person might not be granted bail. So there's certainly a conversation to be had here about the role of bail.
And it's fascinating, too, Professor, that a lot of people, unless they're in the media like I am and my compatriots are teaching it, a lot of people, Professor, really don't understand the concept of bail and how bail works. And, you know, they see a $500,000 bail, but they don't understand that, you know, the person only generally has to put up, 10% of that, and the role of even bail bondsmen in this situation as well. It really is. I think the overall concept, Professor, is kind of understood by people, but the way it actually works maybe isn't.
Right. And I think that's true. And I think that a lot of the, the highly publicized cases where people are making very large bail amounts and getting released as a result of bail bonds, I think that obscures the huge number of people who are kept in prison, in jail for relatively minor offenses because they are unable to make relatively small amounts of bail.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we kind of get this misperception that, wow, people are able to make, you know, millions of dollars of bail because there's a bail bond industry, when the reality is that very, very many people are simply not allowed, not able to make really small amounts of bail.
Yeah.
And so end up in jail prior to further court actions.
And, for example, you know, I have a sitting here, I have a decently price condo. It's not a lot of money, but you know, if somebody puts my bond at $1 million, all I have to do to make that 10% is essentially put my condo or my home up as escrow for the 10%, right?
Right, right. And you know, and again, should the, you know, if you've, and again, if you've been accused of a violent crime, you know, is that something that we would want to do? Is that something that we would want just because a person has the ability to pay?
Yeah.
Is that necessarily a good reason to let them out?
Where does the change, Professor, in the bail issue, where do you think it has to come from? Who has to? And I know there are people yelling about it. New York was a an example of going one way. They admit they may have gone a little too far. They're trying to reel it in. But where does change in the bail system come from? Who starts the conversation?
Well, I think the Sentencing Commission has started that conversation, but I also think that there is, as you pointed out, a lack of awareness about what bail actually involves, and so I do think more media coverage about the types of situations in which people who have committed relatively minor crimes have been required to pay relatively small bail are just left kind of languishing in jail. I think that type of awareness would be really important.
And Professor, finally, final question, as we look back now at a year around plus of the Dulos case, what do you think the coverage of the case, I don't want to say got wrong, but do you think there were one or two aspects of that case that the media could have done a better job in reporting on and given a better picture of to the public or not? Do you think it was fairly covered?
So one of the things that I really think is important with the case is that it did touch on the issue of domestic violence. But I think that there could have been, it could have been framed so that the issue of domestic violence was made even more prominent. Because one of the, and again, I hesitate to say, there's nothing good, comes from this case. But certainly drawing attention to the fact that domestic violence it's not an issue for poor people. It's not an issue for, people living in cities. It's an issue, period, across the board. I think that there could have been an effort to frame this more as, raising awareness about the extent and the pervasiveness of domestic violence that may have been missed. And I realize that some attention was paid to that issue. I think that perhaps more could have been made of that.
Professor and Chair of Sociology, Anthropology, and Criminal Justice at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Professor Alan Bruce. Professor, thank you. Have a wonderful weekend and stay safe. We'll be in touch. Thank you.
You too, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Alan Bruce. I wanted to have this author on because over the past couple of weeks, we've kind of seen that age-old tradition of presidents not taking umbrage with each other or commenting on what a new administration is doing. That kind of got tossed out every window that you could open. The name of the book here is Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump. And our next guest spent 4 years covering the Obama White House for Bloomberg News. She's a former CBS News staffer and a Fox News producer. She lives outside of D.C. Kate Anderson Brower joins us. Hi, Kate. Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Great, Paul. Thanks for having me.
I guess, Kate, I'm no real perceptive inside the Beltway guy, but I guess over the past week or so, that whole graciousness of not commenting on what one administration is doing, Kate, call me crazy, but it sounds like that got tossed out the window on a couple of fronts over the past couple of weeks.
It did, and I think we are heading into the 2020 election very speedily now. And, you know, I interviewed President Trump for this book, and I asked him in our interview, do you feel more empathy for the people who came before you and sat in this office, in the Oval Office? And he said no. So I think that this is a clear sign. We're going to see him really running a de facto campaign against Obama going forward, and Obama is really striking back in a way we've never seen a former president behave before.
Let me ask you before we get into what exactly is going on, because it's fascinating. You know, people rarely get to talk to people who have been close to a president one-on-one. What is Donald Trump like, Kate, to interview and to ask hard questions of? What were your chats with him like?
I found him to be very engaged in the conversation. He was he wanted to talk about these men. I interviewed him at a time when he was, I think, feeling pretty good. So he was in a really good mood when I talked to him. And I think that it was after the Mueller report came out. So he was feeling like he was vindicated in his eyes. And I think that he wants to make it clear that he's different from them. At one point during our interview, he brought out a piece of paper and it said President Trump's list of accomplishments, you know, and he said, look at all I've done, which is just, you know, I covered Obama, as you said, and I can't imagine him ever doing anything like that. He's definitely coming from a defensive crouch, it seems like.
Yeah, that's interesting because, friends of mine who don't follow this stuff like you and I do, they always say, Caden, and obviously you might feel the same way, why doesn't he just let these punches that really aren't going to stick, let them be glancing blows and brush ahead? That's just not in his DNA, is it?
No, and I think that his voters want him to hit back. I mean, it's pretty clear that that's part of his success was that he talks in a very clear, straightforward way. He is an outsider from this elite group of men, and I talk about the women, their first ladies as well, because I've written a book about first ladies, and I'm always interested in women's stories. But he feels like an outsider, and you know, I spoke to him about going to George H.W. Bush's funeral, and he was clearly very flattered to be invited to the funeral, and he said, you know, I would have gotten along with the Bushes if it wasn't for the fact that I had to run against Jeb Bush in 2016, and politics is ugly.
Interesting. So the book is Team of Five, and one of the five presidents you mentioned was former President number 41, George H.W. Bush. He has since left us. Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter. The tradition, Kate, of other presidents maybe giving a speech here or there or writing a book, but not commenting on what the current White House occupant of either party is doing. Is there a moment when that happened, when that was put into place, or has that just kind of been an unwritten rule since day one of this country?
It has not been the case, really. I mean, if you go back and look at John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, you know, the second and third presidents did not like each other for the longest time until they were older, and they famously reconciled. And I actually asked Trump about that and whether he could reconcile with any former president, and he said anything's possible. But I think, you know, it's really more in modern times, and so I'm looking at, you know, the example that was set by George H.W. Bush, that you should, you know, he said, stay the heck out of Dodge. You should get out of town. you should refrain from criticizing the sitting president, because that just undermines whoever is in office, and you need to give them the space to do what they want. And don't go ahead and try to offer your advice unless it's solicited. So I know I've done some reporting during this quarantine about how, you know, the Bush, Clinton, Obama, they all would love to do something, and they would love it if Trump would give them a call to help. But obviously that's not going to happen.
How often, Kate, are former presidents consulted by current occupants of the White House? You know, we tend to find out about that after the fact, right? But it never really makes headlines or makes, you know, the lead story on the news, unless people wanted to. We never really hear about that, but it does happen, right?
It does. I mean, from time to time, there is this exchange. You even saw Richard Nixon visiting Bill Clinton in the White House, and Bill Clinton seeking his advice on foreign policy because he admired how he opened up China, you know, the U.S. to China. And I think that there is times when you see former presidents being very emotional and they're reaching out. I mean, look at George W. Bush is the reason why George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton became so close, because he sent his father and Bill Clinton, who are huge rivals in 92. You know, Bill Clinton is the reason his father was a one-term president. And he sent them on a trip around the world that forged a lifelong friendship between these two men.
And wasn't there an anecdote in there, forgive me if I'm wrong, Kate, but there was an anecdote about some plane rides where the accommodations weren't all that comfortable, and Bill Clinton kind of gave the comfy part of the seat or the bed to number 41. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. And, you know, Bill Clinton constantly was deferring to 41. He was older. And 41 became a father figure to Clinton. He never had a stable father in his life. The Bushes called him a brother from another mother, you know, and Barbara Bush affectionately called them the odd couple. And, you know, she was happy to have another former president in the family. There are all sorts of sweet, funny things between them that you could never have predicted in the 90s. It really started in the mid-2000s when they were sent on that trip.
The name of the book, by the way, Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump. It's available on Amazon, wherever you want to get it. You can get it in a Kindle edition now. And the author is Kate Anderson Brower. One guy that is just really, Kate, kind of the Energizer Bunny who keeps going no matter how sick he gets is Jimmy Carter. He's 90-something now. He still teaches Sunday school. He still builds homes for Habitats for Humanity, or Habitat for Humanity. And he said a few things here and there about President Trump, but he's another aspect of this club, isn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm glad you brought him up, because I went and interviewed him and Rosalynn Carter, his wife, in their very modest home. They live a pretty simple life in Plains, Georgia, a tiny town down in Georgia, where, as you say, he teaches Sunday school. And the story of his post-presidency is an important part of the book, because he didn't know what he was going to do. He was one of the youngest presidents ever to be booted out of office. Really, he wasn't reelected. You know, he was a one-term president. It was devastating when he lost to Reagan. And he goes home to this tiny town. You know, what are you going to do with your life at that point? He was in his 50s, and he decides to in the middle of the night, he wakes up and has a dream that he is going to create this institute that monitors elections in foreign countries and helps bring peace around the world, like he did with the Camp David Peace Accord. And it's kind of incredible. They are a powerhouse. They cook for themselves, the Carters. They are, I mean, it's funny. There's a scene in the book I describe Donald Trump calling Jimmy Carter to get his advice. He's the only president he's really had any real discussions with. And Jimmy Carter is sitting, getting himself some food at a friend's house. He's at their buffet table, serving himself at the buffet table. And he answers the phone and just quietly, you know, talks to the president and then comes back and keeps serving himself. I mean, he's as normal as it gets for a former president.
Interesting stuff. Kate, hang on. We need to take a break. One more segment, please, with Kate Anderson Brower, name of the book, Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump. Fascinating stuff. Back with Kate. Kate Anderson Brower, name of the book, Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump. Check it out wherever you buy your books, BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com, your favorite bookstore, all of that. You know, Kate, if you had asked me prior to the break we took, which one of the five presidents that you profile in this book, the ones previous to Donald Trump, which one of those would have been the least likely to get a phone call from Donald Trump? I would have said Jimmy Carter. Yet it's interesting that right before the break, you pointed out that Donald Trump, who is, you know, Kate, is probably about the most polar opposite of Jimmy Carter ever, that even they spoke together. That's fascinating to me.
It was fascinating to me. I you know, but it makes sense, doesn't it? Because Donald Trump is a self-styled disruptor. He came into the White House to shake things up, to drain the swamp, as he says. And who's swampier than the Clintons and the Bushes and the Obamas? You know, I mean, these are the top of the elite in the political world. And so he looks at Jimmy Carter as someone who's different from these other people. And he lives a very different life. And Jimmy Carter has come out and criticized his successors. He has criticized Bill Clinton. He has criticized George W. Bush for the war in Iraq. I mean, he has not followed the President's Club rules. So I think that Donald Trump has an affinity for that. He sees them in a similar way, even though, like you said, they could not be more different.
You talked about interviewing, Kate, the wives of the ex-presidents. Also, mm-hmm. you talk in this book to family, friends, and aides as well. I'm always fascinated with things I read about the White House aides who are back and forth with the president and these administrations on a daily basis. Talk a little about that.
Well, I interviewed maids and butlers and people who work behind the scenes for my book, The Residents, and I went back to some of them for this book and asked them about what it's like to work for President Trump. And these are the people who see everything. You know, these are the people and the service staff who see it all. And I was surprised by what they told me. You know, they said that behind the scenes, and I interviewed several of them on the record, you know, they said that he's quite actually pretty kind to them, pretty decent. They see him playing with his grandkids. They see a different side of him, that a lot of this bravado and a lot of what we see on Twitter and in public is a bit of an act from the president.
And that, you know what? I think people, Kate, I think by now, 3.5 years in, I think that's what a lot of people, especially his supporters, I think that's what they think, too. You know what I mean? That, oh, yeah, there he goes again on Twitter. Or there he goes again on the press. And he also does it smiling some days. You know what I mean? It's really weird to watch.
Yes, it's bizarre to watch. And, if you don't like Donald Trump, it's probably even more infuriating to know that he's enjoying himself. Right. And what we get to see and what the country goes through is this roller coaster all the time.
Yeah. Kate, final question. You interviewed, obviously, these gentlemen, of course, George H.W. Bush before he passed away. You got to know what was going on there. Which one of the five, other than President Trump, Kate, which one of the five did you walk away from after interviewing him and you walked away with somewhat, a modicum of surprise or something you didn't expect? Which one of those five surprised you, if any?
I mean, I think Donald Trump is the most surprising.
Really?
Because I really did. Yeah, I really went into that interview. You know, you're in the Oval Office. It's so intimidating and overwhelming to be there. And he tried to make me feel comfortable. I mean, he was actually very engaging and in a way that I didn't expect. I thought I was frankly a little bit nervous about how it was going to go, you know, because he does attack journalists so much. So he is a surprising person.
Did you find anything engaging or surprising about Barack Obama?
Obama is very he's very thoughtful, you know, and that's what I always think about. He is just the polar opposite of Donald Trump in every way, right? It takes him a long time to finish a thought. And I think that that's one of the things that people like about Donald Trump is that he just gets to the point, right? There is no, you don't have to wonder what he's thinking. I think Obama's always carefully thinking things through. And I found out in my reporting, you know, that he's got kind of a setup in his post-presidential office where he and his aides have to gather together quite often to decide whether or not to respond to Trump. Hmm. And sometimes Obama really, you know, when Trump accused Obama of wiretapping his campaign office, Obama was very upset, infuriated by that, because it goes against everything that, you know, in a democracy you should stand for. And he had the statement rewritten so that it was even harsher, which for Obama is a lot, because he's not someone who comes out really attacking very often.
Yeah.
But I just think, Trump has pushed him to such a place that he feels like he has no choice but to speak up.
Kate, thank you. This is fascinating stuff for those of us who live it, eat it, and breathe it every day. Team of Five, The President's Club and the Age of Trump. Pick it up wherever you get your books, barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com. Kate Anderson Brower has been the guest. Kate, thank you. Have a happy weekend. Stay safe, and hopefully we can chat in the future. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kate. Appreciate it.